What will it profit this country, accuses the mayor of Detroit, if we put a man on the moon and can't walk through our own city without fear of violence? We aim to pacify Vietnam, but what's the good if we can't pacify the American people? Americans have seen fellow Americans take the law into their own hands, rioting, burning, and looting with almost casual arrogance.
In July 1967, Detroit experienced the largest urban riot in United States history. Detroit residents became restless after police raided an unlicensed drinking club, arresting 82 who had been celebrating the return of two local GIs from the Vietnam War. Unrest in the neighborhood ensued, evolving into a multi-block riot. Eventually, Detroit police were called to action, but they couldn't handle the growing crowd. Governor George Romney activated the Michigan National Guard, though they couldn't handle the crowd either. The federal government ultimately deployed the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions, with Pentagon troubleshooter Sirius Vance flying in to manage the crisis for the White House. Over 5 days, 43 people were killed, more than 1,000 were injured, and some 7,000 were arrested. Ultimately, 412 buildings were burned or damaged enough to be demolished. The social fabric that had been constructing Detroit, once a symbol of American industrial might, was torched alongside the rest of the city. White flight became a wholesale exodus as they abandoned Detroit. The American promise hadn't made it to everyone, and President Lyndon B. Johnson's administration was so tapped out fighting its war on poverty and its war in Vietnam that there were no more resources to throw at the problems on the home front. For Detroit, all they could do was shoot looters, jail others, and wait for anger to dissipate so tanks and soldiers could redeploy elsewhere. But as this anger dissipated, as did interest for Detroit's burgeoning future. The riot accelerated a rapid, racially patterned exodus of capital and people. Auto plants downsized, pressured first by the Clean Air Act of 1970 and later by global competition, resulting in tens of thousands of living wage jobs to vanish. White flight drained the city's tax base. Redlining and predatory lending locked black families out of suburban mortgages and business loans. Amid the chaos, 11-year-old Malik Kenyatta Yakini watched a baseball field he had played on just last summer be converted into a military base for the 101st Airborne. His grandparents had joined thousands of black families who moved to Detroit in its mid-century boom, believing its growing automobile industry and loosening housing covenants promised a better life. There was a real sense of community in the neighborhood, and everyone's parents knew each other. While there were certainly some consequences of the riot in his life, Yakini regards that summer as a watershed moment. In the chaos of the Detroit riots was a tremendous hot fire of black consciousness. This podcast is an introduction to how that 11-year-old boy, Malik Yakini, spent the next 5 decades transforming the trauma of Detroit's post-industrial decline into a blueprint for black food sovereignty. Founding the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and cultivating its D-Town farm to prove that cultural reclamation offers a model for reclaiming self-determination in America's abandoned urban landscapes.
And if someone come to you right now and say, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa.
To understand Malik Yakini's place in today's food system movement, I needed to contextualize the city that shaped him. When Detroit's steel and auto industries collapsed, the aftermath, post-industrial investment, redlining, supermarket flight, hollowed out entire black neighborhoods. Yakini is a compelling leader by himself. His work is really illuminated when seen against the backdrop of his environment. Now, 2 years after the riots, a teacher at Post Junior High played Malcolm X's Message to the Grassroots for Yakini's class. That's what I've just played a clip from. Malcolm X's speech framed liberation as collective self-determination. And this speech had an immediate relevance amid the ashes of the Detroit riots. Despite being 13, Yakini states that many of his inspirations are rooted in hearing Malcolm X for the first time. X's speech directed him to build power from the bottom up. At Eastern Michigan University, he chaired the Black Student Association. They ran a free breakfast program at an elementary school, patterned after the Black Panther Party, and had a co-op called the Ujamaa Co-op Buying Club. Each Saturday, two members made the 40-minute drive to Detroit's Eastern Market and bought produce in bulk, then dividing it among club members and the community. He reflected that he didn't necessarily know anything about the food movement, but he was acting in accordance with cooperative economics. Jump forward to 1989, and Yakini co-founded the Nasoromi Institute Public School Academy. an African-centered K-8 program rooted in unity, self-determination, and collective work. Yekini viewed education as essential to the struggle for Black liberation and was determined to be part of building an alternative to the Detroit public school system, which he believed had largely omitted the true nature of the global Black experience. He ultimately served as its director for 22 years, weaving food and culture into the curriculum. In 2000, Yekini had developed a food security curriculum and started teaching the students organic gardening. The school community took notice, and there was an interest in a larger program. That grew into the Shamba Organic Garden Collective, with about 20 backyards and vacant lots across Detroit becoming personal gardens. They were created by a team known as the Groundbreakers, who would go out and till the new beds for any interested party. As the work continued to grow, Yekini began looking for a way to expand it. Informally, this work grew into the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. In 2006, Yekini called together a group of 40 people who were gardeners, chefs, foodists, people who had some connection to food, for the purpose of starting this food justice network. He sought to address food insecurity among Detroit's African-American community and to organize members of that community to play a more active role in addressing their food security and food sovereignty. He recognized that within a kind of structure where white dominates and has the majority of resources and power, the way marginalized people can gain greater voice and greater access is by banding together so they're operating from a position of strength. Drawing on examples of similar coalitions across the United States, the network drafted policy outlines tailored to Detroit. In 2008, they were successful in persuading the Detroit City Council to adopt the Detroit Food Security Policy, which led to several things: a food system analysis database, data collection on hunger and malnutrition, promotion of alternative food systems like urban agriculture, citizen education, and emergency response planning. Now, I want to take a step back. I brought up food security and food sovereignty. When the network was founded, Yekini understood the goal as addressing food security in Detroit. But as understanding for that term grew, he realized what they were actually looking for was food sovereignty. Food security only addresses having adequate amounts of food. Yekini's mentor Raj Patel quipped, "You can have food security in prison." The network realized that overall, Detroit lacked control over the very systems that provided food. Detroit's challenge was not merely having enough food, it was determining how that food is grown, how it's transported, accessed, justly and democratically. Out of this critique came D-Town Farm. Founded alongside the network, D-Town Farm is its flagship urban agriculture initiative. It began in 2006 on a quarter-acre lot in Detroit's east side, though in 2008 relocated to a 7-acre tract inside the 1,200-acre Rouge Park, becoming Michigan's largest urban farm. From 2006 to 2010, the farm operated entirely on volunteer labor. Today, D-Town Farm has the funds to pay a small team managing its production. They also welcome community volunteers and host classes on how you too can become involved in urban agriculture. They sell their produce at neighborhood farmers markets and at the farm itself. Now, Yekini concedes that, compared to Detroit's overall need for locally grown produce, what they're doing is minuscule. But they argue that they're doing something far more important. They're planting seeds into people's consciousness. Yekini notes that oppressive systems suggest to people that they don't have the capacity to provide for themselves. D-Town Farm rebukes that. Success is not measured only in pounds of produce, but in the number of venues that encourage affordable, self-grown food, and in the eating habits that change as a result. Ultimately, the deeper question is, what does a healthy community look like, and how do you create that? Yekini's answer is a localized food economy. Detroit residents spend millions of dollars a day on food, yet most of that money flows out of the city, creating no jobs, no ownership, no wealth locally. By contrast, D-Town Farm keeps food dollars circulating within the neighborhood, countering extractive corporations that drain Detroit's resources.
All newsmen around the country have watched for years at television pictures of what happens in a riot or in a racial disturbance or just a general disturbance, call it what you will. And we always wonder what it's going to be like when we're right in the center of one, and when you're the target. Well, it's a very strange feeling, because no matter how liberal you may think you are, or how conservative you may be, no matter what your own personal views are, all of a sudden you find that there are folks who live in the same town you do in the same year who hate you enough, at least on given occasions, to attack you. And it makes you kind of wonder. Not because you don't understand it. I suspect we all could list 5 or 6 reasons why something like this starts and why it continues. But because when it gets down to the very personal thing of just one guy against another guy on a street corner in your hometown, then it doesn't make any sense at all. This is Ken Thomas on 12th Street.
Reporting on the Detroit riots, ABC correspondent Ken Thomas recognized that reporters like to imagine what their position would be if they were in a major disturbance. What Ken doesn't know is he's actually reporting on the largest riot since the 1863 New York City draft riots, and the largest riot until the 1992 Los Angeles riots 25 years later. History rarely tells you that you're standing in the middle of it. The same is true about a food shed. We can list half a dozen reasons why our food system is broken, and we can rattle off just as many fixes taken from our academic studies. Yet, the complexity and scale of our food system can spit out any good effort we feed it. Malik Yakini never set out to join a food movement. As a teenager inspired by Malcolm X, he simply believed that cooperative economics could shape how his neighbors ate. That involvement, what we now call prefigurative politics, pulled him from a junior high classroom into five decades of hands-on work. We've walked through more than 50 years of Detroit history and found Yakini at every turn, running free breakfast programs, tilling vacant lots, founding the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and as of recently, opening the Detroit People's Food Co-op, a $22 million project co-owned by 2,600 Michigan residents. His story reminds us that movements are not abstract. They're built on people who decide to act before they fully understand the odds. The food system will remain vast and messy, but engagement is the only way to make a dent, and in the process, to understand it. If Yakini's journey teaches anything, it is that ordinary commitment, sustained over time, can turn abandonment into cultural, political, economic, personal liberation.